Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senator Tony Lorie with Senate File 109, EMS Board and Medical Response Appropriations. We just got a fiscal note last night. Maybe I'll take just 1 minute. I will be brief, as I know we have a long agenda, but kind of talk about the origins of this bill. All of the appropriations come from the Cooper-Sams Longevity Volunteer Ambulance Trust Fund for Longevity Awards, which has carried a balance for some time. Members may recall that last year we did take $6.2 million of that to balance our rather meager deficit compared to what we're facing this time. So several of us realized that that fund is in great jeopardy, and it was established for a purpose, and that is recruitment and retention for our volunteer ambulance and fire associations to be able to survive. So we thought that we should take some of the remaining balance and invest it in areas that would support that recruitment and retention, particularly for rural areas. So I do have a delete everything amendment that I would like to work on. I can describe that. This is not our first hearing, so it can't be offered as an author's amendment. I should describe it, but I would hope we would adopt it. And so with the delete all amendment, it does differ from the fiscal note, but I will describe it briefly. Section 1 requires the Department of Public Safety to collaborate with the Minnesota Ambulance Association and essentially design a medical response unit reimbursement pilot. This for first responders. It would establish 5 sites around the state that would work to try to find a method to reimburse these first responders for delivering patients that have called to the hospitals. Right, currently, there is no way for these units to be reimbursed for these services. What happens is the first responders will show up on the scene. Oftentimes, they would be perfectly capable of transporting patients that are stable and otherwise able to be handled by these well-trained first responders, very professional folks out in the community, but there's no way to reimburse them. We send an ambulance to take over and bring the patient to the medical facilities. And it's long been recognized that we could likely save money by allowing them, these first responders, to actually deliver the patient in cases where that is cost-effective and a safe option in that instance. And so we'd like to roll this out as a pilot project and establish that, and the Department of Public Safety would be the lead agency for that. Section 2 of the bill appropriates $975,000 up from this set-aside fund, $400,000 to be distributed among the 8 regional EMS programs, $100,000 for the comprehensive advanced life support education programs, $25,000 for the EMS for Children program, $200,000 for a grant to the Minnesota Ambulance Association to implement a veterans paramedic apprenticeship program, and $250,000 for the medical response unit pilot project, $75,000 of that for public safety administrative costs, the balance $175,000 to reimburse those pilots that we get going around the state. I've got Buck and OJ here to answer any questions about specifics on each of the projects. I would like to adopt that amendment as soon as...
Well, we don't quite have a quorum yet, so okay. Can I just ask you a question, Senator Lorie? Is the fiscal note drawn to the amendment?
The fiscal note is not drawn to the amendment. The fiscal note is not drawn to the engrossed copy of the bill, even, really. The fiscal note... I'll describe what's in the fiscal note and how the amendment would change this. And it really is pretty straightforward. Again, the Delete Everything Amendment invests $975,000 of the Cooper-Sams Longevity Award Fund. And that would be the full extent of the expenditures. Right now in here is $50,000 of general funds. That was for the EMSRB in the originally drafted bill to actually implement the study. That methodology has changed to have the Department of Public Safety implement the study, and they would get the funds out of the $250,000 in order to do that. So there should be no general funds whatsoever from that. And the total in the originally drafted bill was, 1.45 million. The fund, as all of our funds, lost money recently, and so we tried to bring our number down too, so that we have basically just under a million invested, 950,000 of the approximately 6 million remaining in the fund currently.
So, Senator Laurie, I'm not quite following you when you say there's no general fund money. Where is the money from?
The Cooper Sams.
That is general fund money.
That is, okay.
It
is. On the fiscal note, they call it other fund.
Well, it's in a separate account. It's in a separate account.
Yes.
But the money was originated in the general fund. I mean,
yeah.
It's just general fund money that's earmarked is what it is.
Okay. It's set aside for a specific purpose. Again, in recognition of the fact that we're going to have a hard time maintaining balances in funds that don't need them for this current biennium, funds are probably not going to be sitting around. We thought that taking one of $6 and investing them in recruitment and retention efforts. You know, and one thing I did forget to mention as I was talking is we have been working with the EMSRB, Emergency Medical Services Response Board, regarding this bill, and they have, you know, some concerns. This is the fund that they administer to pay out these longevity awards, which really have been effective at, again, the recruitment and retention efforts, and their position is neutral on this bill, but with concerns. They are concerned about going after this fund at all because of the effectiveness it has had, and I need to, and I know that the executive director is here today to answer any questions, or if we get astray, she might take it upon herself to step up and clarify something, but that's the bill we have before you.
So we can adopt the amendment now. Are there any questions about the motion to adopt the A3 amendment?
On the A3 amendment, I do have one oral change that should be incorporated on line 1.11. I was just reading it. It should, after emergency, we should stick in medical, because that's what it is, the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. So that would be an oral.
So we'll incorporate that into the amendment.
Thank you.
Any further discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Now, Senator Laurie, I just see a few things that are little problems here. I'll just mention them before we set this aside.
Okay.
The first thing is that I was led to believe that we might have some savings out of these expenditures, and the department is telling us that they cannot demonstrate any savings here. The second thing is that you're appropriating money to the Department of Public Safety, which is not in this budget division. So, I mean, in the event we were going to do this, we'd have to, you know, send this bill back to finance, and they'd have to send it over to the public safety, the division that has a Department of Public Safety in their division, because we'd be transferring money out of this division to another division. And I'm not likely to know whether we can actually afford to do this in time to do that. So that might be something for you to ponder.
That is indeed something for me to ponder. on the first issue, regarding the savings, I was let down when I was handed this fiscal note late last night myself that there were no savings identified. I might direct you to page 7 of 9 in the fiscal note if members have that. I don't know. I'll read what the department said about it. This bill does not provide specific details about how or whether this proposal would impact Minnesota healthcare programs reimbursement for transportation services. If the bill were amended to provide more detail about how the Minnesota healthcare programs would be affected by the MRU response reimbursement pilot project, the assumption of no fiscal impact may change. Now, this is a bit of a chicken and egg thing here, you know, because I don't think anybody's really debating the fact or disputing the fact that, you know, that there is great promise in the reimbursement pilot project. I can understand DHS's reluctance to actually tag a number to it because we don't know what the pilot project will say in terms of exactly how it should be structured to save that money, but there's a really good case to be made that if we have first responders there at the scene with the skills and the capability to transfer these patients safely and effectively, they can do it at a much lower cost than actually having the ambulance arrive and take over that service.
Well, Senator Lurie, it shouldn't be too hard if somebody would sit down and figure out, you know, if you're doing this in a region, how many ambulance rides were there in that region in the previous biennium?
We plan on sitting down with the department and further working this over and seeing if we can come up with some of those frameworks and see if we can actually identify an estimate of what the savings would be. So once this is on the table, I would hope that we could. I was handed this late last night and haven't had.
No, I understand that.
To follow up on that, but that's the crux of the matter here. You know, they're to my way of thinking, when I read this, I haven't talked to them yet, but I think I read this as them kind of understanding that, yeah, there probably is savings to be had, but we don't specify in the bill where the 5 pilot projects would be or exactly what the results of the pilot project would come back with. Maybe we can put some framework around this and help the department try to better understand and better estimate what the savings would be. I know that is a continual problem we have in this division as we try to project the savings that we should see from good programs, and if we can't project them, of course we can't build our budget around them. And so I will be working with the agency to try to get some savings booked for this.
Are there any other questions? Okay, if not, then we'll just set this aside, and hopefully more work can happen on it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Senator Lynch. Senate File 986.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am here with Senate File 986 this morning. Members, this is the result of the work group that was put together with regard to health mandates and flexibility. And it was through working with Senator Lurie and Senator Sharon and Senator Rosen that various stakeholders and interest groups brought forward their ideas and suggestions, and what you have before you today is a result of many weeks and months of conversations and discussions. Madam Chair, before I go through the bill, I too last night received a fiscal note.
It's a good thing we were all here, huh?
And those of you that have been involved in this process know that I was pretty committed to bringing this forward with a neutral fiscal note attached to it, with the intent here of trying to offer flexibility and savings to our stakeholders, to our counties and our hospitals, clinics, and various stakeholders. So, Madam Chair, I think before I go through the bill that it might be prudent to take a look and adopt the A-12 amendment. And the A-12 amendment addresses the fiscal note.
Is it here? We just need to wait a minute to get it handed out.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I may, while the A-12 is being passed out, I tried to reach the affected groups prior to offering this A-12 amendment. I'm not sure the degree to which I was successful in doing that, but be assured that the provisions that I felt it necessary to pull out of this bill this morning are not finished. And I have every intention of continuing to work on those matters, but we'll find a different mechanism to do that.
All right, so we have the A-12 amendment. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, then those in favor of the A-12 amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Deletes a lot of sections. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, at this time, I will walk through the sections of the bill. I have two additional amendments, and those would be the A-9 and the A-10. And as we walk through the bill, I can indicate where those come into play, and we can address those at that time. That might make it more clear. So, members, we'll begin on page 1 of the bill, Article 1. There are a number of provisions in this bill. This particular provision has to do with exempting the Department of Health, Food, Beverage, and Lodging licensure requirements for group residential facilities that are licensed and offer services on a 24-hour basis to children. This section requires that exempted facilities employ a contract with a certified food manager. Section 2 of the bill modifies day treatment services by allowing a minimum 2-hour block of time instead of a minimum 3-hour block of time for day treatment services. And again, as we go through these were all measures that were designed to offer efficiencies and flexibility for our stakeholders that are on the ground. Section 3, I will note, was one of the items that was included in the A-12 amendment. So Section 3 of the bill has been deleted. Section 4 requires a level of care determination for children admitted to a treatment foster care setting to occur within 5 days instead of the current 3 days. Section 5. Section 5 is a section that was brought forward by MICA and AMC with regard to cremation and funeral expenses incurred by county agencies. And Madam Chair, at this time, I think that it would be helpful to bring forward the A-9 amendment.
Senator Lynch moves the A-9 amendment. Any questions, any discussion?
Madam Chair, or is it in the packet?
I think it's right here.
get it out.
She has an amendment to it. Just wait a minute till everyone gets a copy of the amendment.
Madam Chair.
We have it.
Can we have an explanation before I vote on it?
Yeah, she has an oral amendment to the amendment, so I think everyone has it, so why don't you indicate what your changes are, Senator Lynch?
Okay. Madam Chair and members, on the A9 amendment, first of all, the oral amendment to the A9 that I'd like to offer is that we would be striking lines 1.6 and 1.7. And beyond that, and for explanation, this section and the amendment before you comes to us as a result of conversations that we've had with the various stakeholders along the way. I think the best way to describe this is the counties are seeking some flexibility to be able to provide for or allow for cremation, and at the same time recognizing the desires of next of kin if they are accessible and available. And so we bring forward the A9. I feel confident in telling you that the stakeholders that have come forward with concerns over this particular provision have agreed to the A9 amendment that's before you today.
Any discussion of the A9 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Lynch, you want to continue?
Okay. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We'll go on to Section 6 of the bill on page 5. Section 6 removes the requirement that a non-county entity receive a recommendation for certification by the provider's host county in order to provide services. The requirement that the non-county entity be certified by the state remains in statute. Section 7 strikes the requirement for a mental health professional to be present on site for at least one observation during the first 12 hours in which the mental health practitioner provides training to the child or the child's family. Section 8, page 8. Provides some technical changes consistent with changes in the previous section and provides some flexibility in providing therapy and services to children. Section 10 eliminates the Children's Mental Health Collaborative anti-supplantation provision in statute.
Are we deleting this?
Section 11 modifies the definition of a child's caseworker to include a person who has the responsibility to visit the child while the child is in foster care. And Section 12 requires the Commissioner of Human Services to revise rules related to the relative foster parents. And doing so while making sure that everything is allowable under federal law. Article 2, page 15, the health care section. Section 1 requires the Commissioner of Health to accept an independent audit on a health plan company by a nationally recognized independent organization. Section 2 revises the schedule for checking incontinent nursing home residents. Section 3 establishes the same protocol for repositioning residents who are unable to change their own position. And then, Madam Chair, this might be an appropriate time to take a look at the A10 amendment.
Right. We have the A10 amendment before us. Senator Lynch moves its adoption. Want to explain the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, the A-10 amendment is a result of some continuing conversations among the stakeholder groups. On line 1.5, that offers clarification for medication reminders. Line 1.12 provides clarification on home health aide qualifications. I would just suggest in this area, actually in this section of statute generally, the home health aide statutes were written not necessarily to reflect the services that we know and provide for today, and I think that this further clarification is going to be not only speaks to sort of common sense, but brings our statutes more in line with the services that we have come to expect and acknowledge in that industry. Further on the A-10 amendment, I'm going to skip forward just a little bit. On page 17, the section 5, what we're doing on line 1.18 in the A-10 amendment is we're deleting the entirety of section 5 in the bill and replacing it with this language. It has to do with deeming language with regard to day training and habilitation. And once again, this is the result of continuing conversations with the department and the stakeholder groups. And I'm very comfortable and pleased with the work, particularly that has been done on this amendment to bring to you today.
I guess maybe this is quite a bit of change. Maybe we should just see before we adopt it if there's anyone that wants to testify on this amendment. I guess not. Any questions? Not, then those in favor of the A-10 amendment indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, members. Continuing on with our walk through the bill, we're on page 16 in section 4. Deletes the requirement for periodic nursing supervision of Class B home care aides and replaces it. Section 5, we just discussed and took care of in part with the A-10 amendment. Section 6 relieves school district and charter schools of the responsibility to provide certain health care information and assistance. Requires the information to be provided on the school district or charter school's website. Section 7
Madam
and Section
Lynch,
8.
What,
yes.
What type of information are we talking about here?
Madam Chair, on page 18, beginning on lines 18.16, this is providing information to each student on the availability of health care coverage through the Minnesota health care programs. And the change reflected here is affording school districts the opportunity to provide that information on their district website. Madam Chair, if I may, this would be a good time to just acknowledge once again that there are a number of provisions in this bill that don't necessarily represent the best case scenarios, but rather are more reflective of our need to and desire to try to provide some flexibility to our
stakeholder groups. Regard to this provision, Senator Lynch, then I imagine the school districts would be okay if they don't get the money that we had budgeted for them to sign kids up for these programs.
That's what the deal is.
This was not an unfunded mandate.
Madam Chair, I'm thinking back in my head, but I have not had any conversations with any of the stakeholder groups, Ed Minnesota, MSBA, or others, with voicing any concerns about this, nor any concerns about any associated funding.
Well, maybe you want to check that out on the way to the next committee.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Lynch, so I know this was put in last year to take care of our health care initiative. And please refresh my memory. Why? What was their complaint? Why was it difficult to go ahead and provide this information to them aside from the web? Is there anybody here?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I'm looking around, and I'm sure if there's someone in the room, they're going to cruise right up here. But this was I don't think that this was so much brought to me in terms of problematic, but rather as one other thing that was required to do. So I don't for a minute sense that it was problematic, but rather in the whole scope of all of the things that are on our plate that we are responsible for accomplishing, this was viewed as something that maybe was something that they felt like could be removed from their plate.
Senator Rosen, apparently the school district still could sign kids up if they want to, and if they did, they would earn the $25 per applicant. And the data exchange about kids that are eligible for a free or reduced lunch that would go to the Department of Education for comparison at the Department of Human Services in terms of children that might not have coverage, that would still be happening.
Okay. Okay.
So I think that helps a little bit to have that understanding.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon?
Madam Chair, it appears, though, that the language has been deleted in here that that would provide for a specialist to be doing that type of outreach and enrollment. It seems like all that's here is the web service.
Madam Chair, Senator Prettner-Solon, you're referencing, I think, lines 18.25. And I think the intent, and council can advise us on this, the intent was, as the chair described, that this is not a requirement, but as an individual district, if you would choose to have that enrollment specialist, you would have the opportunity to do that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Senator Lynch, doesn't that really defeat our efforts, though, at trying to get as many of the children that are eligible enrolled as possible?
Madam Chair and Senator Prettner-Solon, I do think that it doesn't do anything to assist in that effort. And I would be the first to acknowledge that. And again, I would just say that there are any number of things in this bill that we could make arguments on all of the sections in this bill, and many of those arguments have been made. And we tried to really consider due to the situation that we're in, I think that's why it appears in this bill. If we were in a different place in time and our circumstances were different, I'm very confident that this provision wouldn't be in the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prettner-Solon.
Senator Lynch, can either of you refresh my memory? Are they paid based on the position that is created and the jobs that are done, or are they paid based on, are they reimbursed based on enrollee?
My belief is that they're reimbursed based on enrollee. But Senator Pretner-Solon, also, there was no requirement that this person be a full-time equivalent, right, just that somebody have that as part of their job so that if someone needed assistance, they would know who to go to. So I'm not too sure that I feel real comfortable having this language deleted in this either, because I don't think that it's an undue burden, because it isn't like they have to have a full-time equivalent to do this. They just have to, it's just like, you know, somebody has to have it be part of their job description to be the affirmative action officer for the school. And when they do enroll someone, they do get the $25 application bonus. So is this like a really important part of this bill, Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, members, thanks for asking the question. There are portions of this bill that I feel more strongly about than others, and I'm willing to work with whatever the will of this committee would be on this, in this particular section.
Senator Rosen?
Madam Chair, I'd feel more comfortable about this section if I heard the argument. I mean, why it's necessary to take this language out. And I'm not comfortable at all with leaving this section in.
Well, I just have a feeling that having the language left in, there will be more kids that get signed up for health care coverage. And it's a benefit to the school district to have the kids covered as well if something happens, you know. Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I'll put as a potential compromise. If you look at Section 6 in its entirety, lines 18.15 through 18.31, and if you look at the existing language, ignoring the strikeouts, what if on lines 18.25 it read, each district may designate an enrollment specialist?
Well, I can do that now.
That doesn't help me any, but my understanding of this section is really it's lines 18.19 through 18.21 that they really want this deleted, and we don't need this any longer. That's my understanding of the most important part of this.
Madam Chair, members, let me try again. So what I'm suggesting is that we leave the language as it was.
Okay.
And with the suggestion that on line 18.25 that we change that word shall to may. So that, in essence, would keep the language intact, but wouldn't require the district to designate an enrollment specialist. They could designate an enrollment specialist. And I suppose you could argue that they might want to do that to be eligible for that funding.
This is the part they want. Well, Senator Lynch, it doesn't do my heart any good to have a may instead of a shall, because if I get a call from a parent who wants to know how they could get help getting their child signed up, I'm not going to be able to tell them that there is somebody, because I won't know if there is or not. And
Madam Chair?
I think Senator Pretner-Solon.
Madam Chair, I'd be more comfortable if we reinstated B, and then I wouldn't care so much about D. Because they, if
did you
as
say,
Senator,
did you say D as in dog or B as in boy?
Reinstated B as in boy.
I don't believe we need that any longer, because we have in another place in the law that they are transferring the information about the free and reduced lunch program enrollees to the Department of Education, And then the Department of Education is coordinating in terms of transferring information to the Department of Human Services so they can compare it against who's enrolled in our health care programs. So they would know how many or which of these children are not enrolled in a health care program so they can target the outreach efforts.
Madam Chair, who would be doing that, the department or the school?
Department of Human Services and their contractors that do the outreach.
Madam Chair, as long as they're making the determination for eligibility for the free and reduced lunch, why wouldn't they just provide the information to the family at that time?
So simple.
It's just easier for them to provide their tapes to the department.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Why don't we offer the suggestion, just keep lines 25 to 28. Put that back in.
Senator Rosen moves the reinstatement of the language on lines 18.25 through 18.28. Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Lynch, you want to continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Section 7 and Section 8 were deleted as a part of the A12 amendment. Again, those were areas that I hope to continue to work on. And Section 9 specifies that public employers may provide health benefits for their employees through negotiated contributions to self-funded multi-employer health and welfare plans. This section is intended to simplify and clarify current practice. That completes walk through the bill. I do have one bit of good news from my fiscal note that I was particularly excited about. And that is one of the small pieces, and it's small, Madam Chair, but one of the pieces in this bill that we deleted, Section 7, actually, Section 7 on page 18, actually had a positive return, a savings noted on the fiscal note. And so, Madam Chair, I would just like to bring that to the division's attention and request that that particular item be set aside in our pile of things for further consideration as you're putting together our larger finance package.
Yes, thank you, Senator Lynch, for calling that to our attention. Does anyone have any questions on that particular section that is being set aside? Okay, then I believe we have, in your amendments, Senator Lynch, we've removed all the fiscal impact of the bill. And so are there any more questions or discussion about the remaining sections? Senator Lynch?
Madam Chair, if I could just make one final parting comment. And again, my thanks to all of the many stakeholders that have contributed to this discussion. This was a challenging piece of work to put together because there were so many different entities involved in this. But I do think that we've come forward with some good things, and we've had some difficult discussions. And I'm just very appreciative of the work that everyone has done on this.
Okay. Then Senator Lynch, do you want to make a motion?
Madam Chair, I would like to move that Senate File 986 be recommended to pass and
as amended,
and referred to
go to the full Finance Committee.
Full Finance.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Lynch, for your good work on this issue. Next, we have Senator Sharon. Chair Sharon, this was another idea that I was led to believe might have fiscal savings.
Cost savings. Thank you very much. I am happy to be here with you today to introduce Senate File 710, Consumer Directed Community Supports Budget Methodology. And there is an A2 Delete Everything Amendment.
And is the fiscal note drafted to the amendment?
The fiscal note is not drafted to the amendment, so there'll be revisions to the fiscal note.
Members, when you know you're going to have an amendment, it is a good idea to have the staff forward it to the department because it does save them from having to then do extra work. And we want to be mindful of the work they have to do since we're all having difficulty getting our work done these days.
Thank you, Senator.
Is it your belief that this amendment is going to reduce the fiscal note?
It is our belief that it will reduce the fiscal note to be neutral, if not show some savings. And I think they're overwhelmed. We have had the amendment available for a fiscal note for about a week.
Okay. Senator Sharon moves adoption of the A2 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the motion is adopted. Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. This consumer-directed community-based supports is a program for people that have intellectual or developmental disabilities and make choices about where they want to live and where they want to work. What is needed is a correction that allows persons who are on these consumer-directed waivers to be able to stay on them by changing the methodology by which the payments are made under the consumer-directed program. Currently, the persons who use this waiver tend to be in school. And because there are a number of other support services available for persons with these disabilities while they're in school, the methodology for payment under the consumer-directed program can work for them. But once they leave school and those various support services are no longer available to them, then this program, based on the methodology for how it's reimbursed, becomes not funded at a level that they're able to retain the community-based living in the manner that they'd like to. So they move to a more expensive waivered service program. What this bill is about is attempting to change the methodology by which the consumer-directed services payment is made and directs the department to pursue the changes with CMS. And
Let me interrupt you for a minute just to let the members know that it does appear that this fiscal note is drafted to the A2 amendment. So I just thought we should know that for clarification here.
With your permission, Chair Berglund.
Hi, I'm Heidi Hamilton with the Department of Human Services. The fiscal note is on the previous language. There was a miscommunication in the tracking system when previously there was a request on a fiscal note on an amended version before the amendment was received. And so it says A2, although it's really the previous version.
Oh. Okay. So you would be doing a new fiscal note based on the amendment?
Yes.
All right. Thank you for that clarification. No.
So these consumer-directed community support services that we're talking about today is an option available under medical assistance to individuals with disabilities and families who have children with disabilities. It lets them have control over their funding and supports and spend their dollars cost-effectively. Out-of-home placements are more expensive than supporting persons at home through CDCS services. $1,000. 1,400 individuals with disabilities currently are under consumer-directed community support services. It's a program that's with developmental disability waiver. This is down over 3,000 on CDCS several years ago when a new funding formula was implemented in 2004. The CDCS option was no longer financially viable for most adults after they left schools. This particular kind of waiver preserves persons with disabilities' ability to stay at home, protects their health and safety, and helps prevent financial crises in families. Because families and individuals with disabilities have control over their budgets, they can pay for individualized supports that meet their needs and retain necessary staff support rather than paying for services that they do not need and that are more expensive. Figures from the Minnesota Department of Human Services indicate that services per person cost more than $23,000 less under waivered services than in institutional settings. So this bill, in essence, is an effort to make the changes that are needed in this particular consumer-directed community support budget methodology to make sense for people to utilize after they're out of high school, after they're out of college. So with that, I would present to you some testifiers who are going to talk with you about what it was, why they had to leave the service, and for the counties to talk about how this might benefit them. And also, we have Steve Larson with us from ARC who can answer any more difficult and technical questions that you may have about the bill. And I'd like to begin with presenting Cindy Johnson of ARC of Minnesota.
Hi, good morning, Senator Berglund, members of the committee. I'm Cindy Johnson. I do work with the ARC of Minnesota, and I've got a daughter she's 26 now with developmental disabilities. We utilize the CDCS program from its inception, and it was really the best way to provide services for her. She was able to stay at home. In 2005, when the budget methodology changed by the state, we lost 30%. I think we lost 40% of our budget, and there was no accommodation made in that methodology for people who were leaving high school or college, and it hit us right at that time. And the amount of money available on that program then forced us back. I either had to place her out of home, which we weren't ready to do, or go back to traditional services. And that did cost a lot of money, more money. We had to appeal. I think we appealed two or three times to get the amount of money that we needed to take care of her. I did spend 2 years working with the Department of Human Services on the Budget Methodology Committee, and there was two things that came out of that committee that when the methodology was done, it was really flawed. It didn't account for people needing day services. You know, when they're in school all day, they don't need the money. But then when they're not in school, it didn't account for including that amount of money. And that's what this bill is attempting to do, is provide the day service money back into the budgets for people so they can stay on this option. Going back to the traditional services does cost more. So I would really recommend passage of this. I think it'll help a lot of families. It's really hard when your child is leaving the school system and there's so many things changing to have to change your whole service system again. Thank you.
Any questions?
Chair Berglund, I'd like to introduce Beth Peterson from Lutheran Social Services.
Hi, I'm Beth Peterson. I'm the Director of Services for Partners in Community Supports. We are a subsidiary of Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. Partners in Community Supports is the physical support entity that helps families who are choosing the CDCS option. What we have found is that we have, right now, over 120 families that are currently using a more traditional service because they can't get their services met during the day. A gentleman that I work with is just in January. He just went off of consumer-directed services. He's an artist, and he needed to have some services during the day. He needed somebody who could get him to his studio in order to create his work. He had to go off of CDCS because it didn't allow for him to have anybody give him a ride to work. It didn't allow for him to have anybody support him while he was there. So he went off of CDCS. He went to more traditional services. And in fact, the services that he received now cost two times as much as they did prior to him just being on CDCS. In addition, we have easily over 120 families that in April of 2005 went off of CDCS
and shows what Cindy did, which is to not lose the money that they had before because they had to have services during the day. As a result, then these people chose a more expensive service. But then they also lost the flexibility. The greatest part about consumer-directed services is it allows people to choose how they want to spend their money and where they want to spend their money. And as a result, there's a really high level of customer satisfaction. People that use CDCS really like the service model. It also improves their care. But more than that, it also saves money for the whole, for the county and for the state as a whole. I think what's interesting is that I've been a provider of consumer-directed services since the service started, and we have consistently seen the trend of people when they hit that age of graduating from school going off of CDCS and choosing a more traditional service, which ultimately costs a lot more money.
Thank you, Beth. And Chair Berglund, I just would like to, in terms of Senate File 710, speak specifically to the bill. I want to draw the committee's attention to a couple of things. What the bill actually does is requires an increase in the consumer-directed community supports budget methodology for adults and cannot access school due to graduation or age. Section 1 requires an increase in the consumer-directed community supports budget methodology for adults on developmental disability waivers who cannot access school age. But what I want you to note in Section 1 is that the increase is effective from October 1st, 2009 to June 30th, 2011. So there is a sunset on this section. Section 2 requires the same increases for adults in the waiver programs for persons with disabilities. And Section 3 then requires the Commissioner of Human Services to report by February 15th, so within a couple of years or just a little over a year, on the fiscal impact of the budget methodology changes. So this allows us at that point to check out our assumptions about this. We're confident that it will demonstrate significant cost savings, but then we can continue the process at that time based on us validating those assumptions.
Are there any questions? Have you completed your witnesses?
Yes, we have, although Steve Larson is here from ARC if there's anybody who would have more sophisticated questions that I'm not able to answer.
Well, I think we need to set this aside and get another fiscal note done on the amendment and see where we're at then.
Will that mean that we'll come again for action of the committee?
Oh, I don't know. We'll have the fiscal note in front of us at some time, but I don't know if we'll actually reschedule the bill.
Can we, I'm just uncertain, does that mean that this would move forward given a positive outcome from the fiscal note? Or do I need to have an action from the committee in order for this to move forward?
Well, it can be set aside for consideration in the omnibus bill, which is what we're doing with most of these things.
Madam Chair.
I mean, we shouldn't decide what we're doing before we get a fiscal note. That's part of what this committee is about, is to make evaluations based on fiscal notes. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, I just had to step out for a minute. Can you tell me why the new fiscal note, the amendment would reflect a different fiscal note and where the savings would come in? Because this is a pretty expensive, high-priced fiscal note, so I'm wondering where exactly you're going to see the savings.
The fiscal note that you're looking at is not from the original amendment.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I'll have Mr. Larson answer your question.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I'm Steve Larson with the ARC of Minnesota. Senator Rosen, we've been working with the Department of Human Services to modify the language to try to reduce the fiscal note to being neutral. Some of the things, points that haven't been made so far in this hearing is that there are no new people going to be served as a result of this. These are individuals that are already on the waiver program, and we're trying to work with the Department of Human Services so that they can stay on CDCS and demonstrate that they won't be increasing costs. When they go on to the more formal services, the county's already budget anticipating people graduating from school and having to pay $10,000, $15,000, or $20,000 for them to attend employment or day training habilitation programs. We believe that those individuals could serve or meet their day support needs or employment needs for less amount of money than that. And so that's why we're continuing to work with the Department of Human Services on the fiscal note and the language in order to make sure that we get to that point.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. We'll just set this aside then, Senator Sharon.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Next bill we have on the agenda is Senator Cohen's deficiency funding for state agencies, which in this case happens to be the Minnesota Sex Offender Program.
Madam Chair, members, thanks. You know, every year we have a deficiency bill, and it's not something that for amendments on. It's promulgated through the Finance Department. There are actually two parts of the bill. Obviously, Madam Chair, the bill has been heard in your division because of the sex offender part of the bill, not the disaster match
right.
part of it. So. I know you've spent quite a bit of time on this and wanted to make sure that the figure was appropriate for what was needed. You and I have discussed this, and I think we both have similar positions and feelings relative to how this program has been handled by the administration. And, Madam Chair, I certainly am happy to defer to some of the work you've done relative to what is the second paragraph of the bill relative to the sex offender program. I know you mentioned yesterday you had some language.
We're still working on it. The language I described to you is here, but it isn't quite enough to cover this expenditure, so we're working on getting some additional language worked into the amendment.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, would you like to pass the bill to the full committee, have me hold on to the bill until you have the language ready?
What I'd like to do right now, Senator Cohen, is just to discuss the reason this deficiency is here
Fine.
Before us.
Okay, and let me just indicate, so you're not looking to amend the language today?
Yes.
Yes, you are? Or
yes, we are.
Okay. I don't know if Mr. Godfrey's had a chance to just run it by Mr. Mossman or not, but...
He did.
Okay. All right. Fine. Because I didn't have a chance to talk to him. But do you have...
Senator Cohen, the reason I'd like to talk a little bit about why this deficiency request is here is because I believe that there was overspending of this appropriation in the last biennium, or in this biennium. And I would like to make it very clear that that's not okay. I know that there is an attitude... among some people in the administration that whatever the sex offender program asks for, the sex offender program will get. And I want to start changing that idea because every time we have to increase funding for this program, whenever we're in flat or budget deficit times, we have to cut another program in this division to fund it. And Senator Cohen, I believe that you know how difficult that is to be cutting other programs in order to fund a deficiency like this. So that's why I wanted to spend a few minutes just talking about it. And I know that the department is here and they have this little handout for us to look at. And I thought maybe they could just come up and explain the handout to the members of the committee.
I'm sure that'd be a good idea, certainly. And has the handout been distributed to committee members?
Yes.
It's possible that I could get a copy of it?
Patrick will bring you one.
Well, Madam Chair, I'd be very interested to hear from people from the department as well. So.
Sorry.
Madam Chair and members. I'm Dennis Benson. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. With me today is Dan Storkamp, the Deputy Director. We're here to very quickly walk through the handout that is in your packets to try to give some insight into the deficiency that was incurred by the sex offender program during the course of the last biennium. The front page just basically indicates the sites that we're located. We have two facilities up north. We're involved in two buildings at the prison up at Moose Lake. We have the sex offender program up there, the hospital, which is about, 500 yards away. And then we have about 175 patients down at St. Peter. If you turn to slide two, this top graph just indicates where we were about a year ago. Last March, when I came on board, Mr. Storkamp came on a couple months later, we were on a trajectory to end the biennium with about a $25 million deficit. We've done some things over the course of the past year to bring that deficiency amount down to about $16 million is what we're projecting today. Basically, we've held over 150 positions open in that time frame. During that same period in time, we've added about 90 patients. We've greatly reduced the use of overtime. We've reduced administrative costs, simplified structure, contract costs, one-time costs, and we've implemented a new budget structure and new centralized assignments and staffing, which has helped curb the overtime. If you go to slide number four on page three at the top, the two primary drivers of the deficiency budget were the department a couple of years ago thought that the building would be completed, the 400-bed building that we was bonded 2 years ago, I believe, 3 years ago, sooner than it was. So they were projecting savings of $7.4 million. The building was not started on time and obviously not completed on time. The chart at the bottom indicates some of the delays. It was supposed to be completed in October of 08. Then it was projected March of 09. When I got there, they were telling me October of 09. We have worked very closely with Department of Administration. We've got that back to actually we hope to get possession of the building around May 1, but we still need a month or two to debug it, clean it, get it ready for occupancy, so we should be in by July 1st of 09. That's our target date as we sit here today. So that projected savings did not come to fruition, obviously, $7.5 million. In addition to that, the second piece of the or major contributing factor is the fact that we were then underfunded. As you know, the population grew very dramatically during the past 5 years, and the Department of Human Services had to rent beds from the Department of Corrections. Department of Corrections, in turn, had to rent beds from a private contractor out in Appleton, Minnesota. We were funded to the tune of $2.68 million for fiscal year 9. And the reality is the rent is going to cost us 8.285, leaving us about 5.6 short. So those are the two numbers that really drive the deficiency. It results in a $13.084 million deficiency, those two pieces of the equation. In addition to that, if you look at on the bottom of page four, slide seven, K building delays again, no efficiencies in 09, lots and lots of growth, patient growth since 2003. We had three sites. There was decentralized scheduling in each of the living units that we have fixed. Startup costs at the annex. And lots of staff were hired when we moved into the prison annex, which again is located about 500 yards from the hospital. And the department, MSOP, just simply didn't know what to expect when they moved into those annex buildings. They certainly are not consistent with design for a treatment facility, so lots of security staff were hired. After we got in there, when I came on board, they had about a year of experience with those buildings. We understood what the staffing ratio should look like, and then we started to hold positions open. And again, as I said, we have held over 150 positions open during the course of the last year. Some of those line level, some of them middle management, and even management level positions. We have not compromised delivery of treatment, however. Security precautions, as you know, there were two high visibility escapes, 2005, 2006. There was, there was going to be an error, it was going to be in the interest of public safety. The department simply did not want to have another tragedy, another escape from one of their hospitals. So I think they did some things in terms of staffing, maybe even overstaffing to ensure public safety as they moved some of the more problematic and non-participating patients from the St. Peter campus up to the Moose Lake prison facility. If you turn to page five.
Maybe I could just interrupt you here and ask a couple of questions.
Sure.
First question has to do with the construction contract. And since I know this is not the end of building for you all, I'm wondering if you've ever considered or if you've ever had in the past a performance provision in your contract so that the deliverables either arrive on time or there are penalties in the contract for the contractor.
Madam Chair and members, yes, we have. When I was with the Department of Corrections, we bonded close to $500 million in projects. And more than once, we had performance clauses in the contract. And in fact, there's a performance clause in this contract. It's not, I don't know how much teeth we're going to be able to put into it, but the clause today, I believe, comes to about $6,500 a day for each day it's delayed after March 9th. So we will continue to negotiate, or Department of Administration will continue to negotiate with the builder, as they are really, the building belongs to them until it's completed, then it's turned over to us. So that's one piece of the delay. The other piece was, I think it was an optimistic start date was established, and getting the bond and getting the pre-design completed, all of that, there were some delays. There were also soil problems. And in defense of the contractor, I also have to say, you didn't get all the rain last summer down here and spring that they got up there. It was a very, very, very wet spring. There were, when they got into the soil, there were complexities with the soil. Soil had to be removed and replaced with sand. That took, that delayed the project. So, and again, having gone through these many, many times in corrections, I can't remember a project that when we started the project, it was completed precisely on the completion date. So we have that experience. I think it was optimistic to believe that it would have been completed earlier than it probably is going to be completed. So we will continue to work with Department of Administration on those performance clauses as we move forward, because you are correct. We have the population continues to grow, and our needs in terms of beds are going to continue to grow.
So, Mr. Benson, in regard to the performance elements of the contract, when the department would collect on that stipulation in the contract, what would happen with that money?
Madam Chair, I guess I'd have to ask Department of Administration to speak to that issue. I'm not real clear on that.
Does it go to the general fund, or is it returned to your budget?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Well, I think we both would probably like to know that.
Madam Chair.
And I think we'd like to know what estimate we have of what that amount might be.
Madam Chair, and members, I think we need to understand that the contractor is going to make the case that the delays were beyond their control, that there were soil problems, that there were weather issues. So I think it is probably premature to start spending that money. I can tell you that at $65 a day or $6,500 a day, March 9th to April 30th, which is a date that they're scheduled to give it to us, is what, that's 30, 40, 50 days. So it's going to be, I don't know. Somebody got to have a calculator. You can.
3 million. Or no, is it 3 million?
No, I think it's going to be that much.
300,000?
300,000 in that area.
Well, I didn't indicate we were spending it yet, but it is something to keep our eye on and something to continue to monitor. And if we're not aware of it, then we can't be monitoring it. Mr. Storkamp?
Madam Chair, members, for the record, I'm Dan Storkamp, Deputy Director, talking with Department of Finance and our finance person. The dollars will actually go back to debt service as opposed to coming to the MSOP program or our operational budget.
Goes to offset debt service?
Correct. That is where the, Madam Chair, members, that is where the funding is coming from to pay for the project at this point. So what happens is it goes back to that same account, as I understand it.
Well, the type of penalty that I was thinking of was in regard to the operating costs that you're incurring as a result of the delay. So I guess I would think that if you have an opportunity to structure a construction contract in the future, that you might want to keep that risk that you bear in mind.
Madam Chair, we will certainly keep that in mind moving forward.
There are a couple of other questions here. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Benson. And actually, I was going to ask you the same thing about a performance contract that Senator Berglund raised. And I guess phrasing it a little bit differently, when you present your budget to the legislature and based on a date that you're expecting for completion, is that the date that goes into your contract in terms of a performance date? Because I would anticipate that if you're coming to us with numbers based on a date, that should be the date that's in the contract. Otherwise, it would be kind of misrepresenting to the legislature what you would expect those costs to be if you're anticipating an earlier date, but that's not the date that's reflected in your contract. So that's one question I had. And then the second question is, I would assume, maybe this is the same thing as the other witness testified to, but, I mean, normally when you have a performance date in the contract and then there's a penalty, that penalty would just be deducted from your final payment. So you wouldn't make that final payment until you've resolved whatever penalty there would be, so that in that sense it would end up coming from that same fund, I would assume.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Benson.
And Senator Olson, I can tell you, again, I was not here when this project was bonded. But again, given my history with bonding projects, I think when a bonding presentation occurs, it, generally speaking, is not nailed down at that. When the bonding bill is signed into law, it's not known precisely what the completion date is going to be. That is negotiated once all the pre-design is completed, a contractor is selected, and then the Department of Department of Administration and the contractor establish and agree upon a completion date. So it's kind of after the bonding fact that date becomes known. And my understanding is there were some assumptions made that this project would be completed a little bit sooner than was established once the contractor was selected and that date was firmed up. So my experience is that that's after the bonding bill passes. So again, I think going forward, we have to leave some room for things like a rainy spring, bad soil, and certainly look toward those performance clauses that I think protect the interest of the state with respect to additional costs for operations.
Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Benson, you a little while ago you mentioned that you're having to rent some beds from Appleton, I think you said. And I guess I'm just kind of wondering how does that compare what your projected cost is going to be in this new facility per person compared to if we sent them to a institution like Appleton? Is it going to be a lot more cost? I don't know if you understand my question.
Mr. Benz.
Madam Chair and Senator Coring, just to clarify, MSOP did not rent beds from Appleton. We actually moved into two prison units up at the Moose Lake Prison. Subsequent to that, the prison rented about 210 beds from Appleton to house their offenders. And the cost for offenders is dramatically different than patients.
Okay.
We have to provide a variety of different amenities and services and certainly treatment to patients. So we moved into the buildings. We built a fence, had sight and sound separation up at the correctional facility. We're still there, and we will be out of there hopefully July 1st when our first 400-bed building is done. So that's why this has been such an expensive biennium for this program, because the department has essentially had to pay twice.
So then, Madam Chair, can I just ask one other question?
So then,
Mr. Benson, so then when you move out of the facility that you're in now, that'll free up those beds for the Department of Corrections, and then they'll move into there, so we're not renting private beds? Okay.
In regard to the amount you're being charged for the beds you're renting, I guess I have some questions about how the amount was arrived at for the rent.
Madam Chair and members, that was negotiated between the Department of Corrections and Department of Human Services a couple of years ago. We're paying essentially what they pay to Appleton. In addition to that, we pay some additional costs for maintenance that they provide. There are some security stations that they also provide. They pay for, there's a food negotiation there as well. There are some other ancillary costs. So our Department of Finance Executive Budget Officer was involved in those negotiations a couple of years ago.
What is the per bed cost of the amount that you're paying for the rent?
Madam Chair and members, I don't have that with me. We can get that for you.
I'd appreciate it, because it seems to me, from where I look at it, that it's a lot more than the Department of Corrections claims their average daily per diem is.
Madam Chair, certainly we're paying, I think the again, we'll get you a precise number, but we're paying the per diem that they have to pay Appleton. In addition to that, there are some administrative costs that go into their per diem as well. And I need to tell you that I was at the table when that was negotiated, and certainly I think Corrections was treated fairly, but I think EHS was treated fairly as well. I would, Madam Chair and members, like to call your attention to page 6 of the handout, the top of the page, which kind of gives you a thumbnail sketch of where we're at with daily costs and where this program is headed if we can continue to get into more efficient buildings and sites. The per diem was high in 08 and 09, and it was driven by those rent costs, again paying twice for some of these patients. As we get into our new building this next year, in fiscal year 10, we believe it can come down to 315, and in fiscal year 11, we can get it under that $300 a day mark. I would just, in fiscal year 12, then it comes to 278. The national average for a civil commit program, that really kind of puts us in the middle of the pack if we get down to that 280, 281, I think, Wisconsin, our neighbors, 285 a day. So with the efficiencies of the new building, on-site infrastructure, in managing folks in two sites instead of three sites, we can work on getting this program more and more efficient as we move forward.
Mr. Benson, are you anticipating having to rent beds from the Department of Corrections again in the future?
Madam Chair and members, we have, as you indicated, additional bonding needs. Obviously, there is no governor's bonding initiative this year. We will continue to discuss our population pressures with the administration, and our concern is going to be right now with the projections where they're at. We believe that we are going to fill the new building that we're going to take possession of July 1 by the end of 2011. So there's some need to continue to discuss this project as we look forward to the bonding bill next year.
We did make a plea for you in the Senate bonding bill for this year. We were not successful. Other projects that have been funded in the bill in the past took precedent. My own feeling is you can pay me now or you can pay me later, and it seemed to me like it would have been a good idea to put a down payment on this future building now. But I was not successful in that effort thus far. Perhaps there can be more success in the House. I know they haven't finished their bill over there yet. Mr. Benson.
Madam Chair and members, obviously, whether we rent from Corrections or look at other alternatives, if our second phase of this project is not completed on time, that is going to drive daily costs upward again. So our chart becomes null and void if we can't continue to bring on these more efficient beds.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I got a couple of comments, a question and a comment. I guess going back to the performance, the contract performance, living just a few miles from the facility, I can attest to the rain and the soil conditions. I didn't get some of my planting done. I got stuck several times trying to get some work done. But that said, I did visit about 2 weeks ago on a Friday. We showed up at, 3:30 or 4 o'clock, and I expected, honestly, a beehive of activity in a building that we're trying to get open. And there was only two workers there that I saw actually working toward completion of it. I did have explained to me that they switched to a 4-10-hour, 4-day, 10-hour schedule, 10-hour a day, 4 days a week. But I'm thinking 5 or 6 10-hour days might be in line very soon here.
in order to get our completion date moved up as far as it could.
Mr. Manson.
Madam Chair and members, Senator, I think I was there the same day you were, and we had that discussion. I had also happened to be there that Monday, and there were 130 workers on site. They are working. Some of the subs are working now 7 12-hour days. Many of them are working 5, 6, and 7 10-hour days. So I don't know what happened that Friday. That always happens to us. It never fails. But I can tell you when I was up there on Monday, you could hardly move for contractors. So I think that they have stepped it up. I just have to say that the Department of Administration has really stepped up to the plate with respect to moving this project forward. They have worked very, very closely with the contractor and the architect and leaned on them to bring in a new project manager, set more aggressive goals. And a year ago, they were all working for 10-hour days. And it was frustrating for us because there was a lot of work to do. They had a very, very wet spring. They didn't get the road in the fall before. So they were delayed about 6 weeks getting even to the site with that great big sky crane to set the panels in place. So they were behind the eight ball. But Department of Administration has done a nice job of trying to protect our interest with respect to this project.
Senator Laurie?
Yeah, thank you for that. And then I did have one other question, and it's regarding kind of the staffing levels. And if we go ahead and do this deficiency funding, do you have, you know, there's a lot of concern locally about exactly what type of staffing ratio we're working toward under this new system and what the deficiency funding would do to that. And do you have, I know you've had a hiring freeze on and you've approached many staff reductions in that, but do you anticipate additional layoffs even if we do this? If you're going to go to that, is there a distribution between administrative and direct line workers that you can speak to?
Madam Chair and members, we have not, other than I believe 10 or 11 kitchen workers, we have not laid off any line-level staff at either site. Now, at our St. Peter site, of course, MSH has laid some folks off and they bump into MSOP, so ultimately our staff, because it's the same bargaining seniority unit, get bumped. But we have not. We have tried to manage this problem through attrition. We wanted to move very carefully and cautiously. We want to understand exactly what it's going to take to manage this population under these circumstances in these new buildings. My experience in corrections tells me you never quite know until you get into them. We've done some shifts in terms of how we deliver treatment as well. So some of the treatment functions that line level staff were involved in are going to diminish a bit and be picked up by clinical staff, a lot of the recording. So we think we can get by with a few less. We are on track to our plan was, I think it's about another 50 or 55 between both sites. But again, the right way to manage that is through attrition. And it might end up being 40. It might end up being 60. I think we need to understand what our number is. The $16 million will get us to the end of the biennium if attrition continues at its current rate, which is about 1 or 1.25 a week. So if attrition stops, then we're going to have to look at some alternative measures even the last 3 months here, because the $16 million is a very real number. It has vacillated between 15.8 and 16.2 the last couple of months, which tells me the $16 million, about 80-85% of our costs are staff salaries. I think that's in here somewhere as well. So we don't have a lot of room to manage this budget other than salaries. We have tried very hard to watch our spending this past year. And again, if you understand the trajectory was a $25 million deficit, we're down to $16 million. And I think that's a tribute to hard work of a lot of staff at a lot of levels in both locations.
Madam Chair, Mr. Benson, just to summarize then, basically you have no plans for a layoff under your current structure. I mean, there's some contingencies in there. If things don't go as planned, you may have to rethink, but there are no current plans for any layoffs in the MSOP staff.
Madam Chair.
Senator Benson.
And Senator Lurie, again, I think for the most part that's safe this year. We can't commit to the next biennium until we understand how much money we get for our growth. We have a budget request in, obviously. There is this population continues to increase around 70, 75 a year. And we need funding accordingly. I think the good news is as these people come on, the marginal cost is much more tolerable now than it has been. It costs about $150 a day for each patient that we add, which ultimately will bring that overall per diem down because we're starting to realize some economy of scale. But I think our budget request is around $14 million for the next biennium. That funds growth. That funds a cut that was in the tails last year, and it also funds getting down that additional 50 positions through attrition.
Mr. Benson, before we move off of it, I did want to make clear that we would like to have the information about the transaction for the rent on the beds. I mean, even if this whole thing wasn't transparent beforehand, I think it'd be nice if it could be transparent after the fact. And just in case there ever is a need to rent beds again, we'd understand that better. The second thing I'd like to ask you is whether you've taken into account the county share in your budget against the $16 million so that... The increased spending generates an increase in the county share, and where is that accounted for here?
Madam Chair and members, the county share actually is taken at the Department of Administration, or should say Department of Finance, and what they do is they fund, as you have appropriated to us, our total amount, but the county share is actually 10%. The counties do come back, and that's a target that DHS has to meet to pay back the general fund for the 10%.
So that was about as clear as mud.
I apologize. Madam Chair, members, let's make that real clear then. The counties do pay 10% of the additional cost. That will be accounted for in the general fund, but that's not a part of the MSOP budget.
So the general fund gets off of this transaction $1.6 million.
Madam Chair and members, no, that's not correct. This is real dollars that we need.
I understand you need this money, but when this bill is passed and signed by the governor, I believe then we leave this biennial budget $1.6 million better off than it was.
Madam Chair, my understanding is the 10% has already been included in the equation. That money is already spent. The budget plus the county's 10% is spent. When the appropriation was made 2 years ago or a year and 9 months ago, that was part of that equation. So that money is gone as of the end of this month.
Well, it isn't gone. If you were not spending this increased amount, the counties wouldn't be contributing an increased amount. And certainly we, when we budget your budget, we do take that into account as revenue, and we don't have that revenue showing up anywhere that I'm aware of at the moment. So it seems to me that we can reduce the appropriation that you're requesting by that amount, because you'll be getting that amount from the revenue that's generated through the Department of Administration. Okay. I think I've got it now. We still need to give you the $16 million, but we can reduce the revenue that we are generating up here at this table to pay for it by $1.6 million, because that revenue will be generated through the receipt of a county share.
Madam Chair, I believe that's correct.
So we're just going to need a few minutes just to do a little bit more work on the amendment. And so, Senator Coring?
Madam Chair, just more of a comment than anything. I will just say that the sex offenders program is, for me and I believe for other members, is a hard pill to swallow because it's so much money. And so I will say, Mr. Benson, when you were with the Department of Corrections and Corrections was in this division, I think you did a very good job of trying to educate us on where you're spending money and how you're doing. And so I'm hoping that after session is over with, that I will be invited up to this new facility, and you can kind of try to explain to me. I can't for the life of me understand how one person can cost $368 a day. I just can't fathom that. And you don't have to explain it now, but I would like to have it explained to me so I can understand this in the future. What is plugged into that number? Because it's just, that's
Senator Coring, you'd probably like to, on your way up there, stop at the MITO program. That's $900 a day.
Okay. No, I don't think I want to see that one. But if you could just, if that could be done, I think it would be helpful as a legislator. So,
Madam Chair,
just
very quickly, Senator Coring, we're happy to entertain any of the legislators up there and try to help you understand the complexity of this program. I can tell you that for 30 years sitting over in corrections, I asked the same questions. And I've been here a year now, and I don't think it has to cost $368 a day. The real cost is even higher than that when you include the deficiency piece. But I think we're going to be hard-pressed, given all the givens, if we're statutorily required to treat these people to get it under 270, 280. We think if we get the second building and it's full, which heaven help us all if we continue on this trajectory of growth, but we think we can get it down under that 260 or 270 number with having two sites and sight lines and treatment rooms that are strategically located. But it's always going to be an expensive program. California's program, I think, is $600 or $700 a day. New York is around $400 a day. Again, as I mentioned, Wisconsin is $285, I believe. So these are not cheap programs. These people are civilly committed. They're not criminally committed. We can't lock them down the way we can lock offenders down. Their civil rights have been restored. We're treating 100% of them. Corrections doesn't have to treat. They do. They do a remarkable job of providing treatment, but they aren't required by statute to provide treatment to 100%. We have about 80% participation, but we'll get into that when you come to visit.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just
process question and policy question. One, I hope that at some point we're able to entertain a discussion on this growth in this trajectory that we're on. And the second point that I would just like to make is, Madam Chair, what is the process when a situation like this happens with one of our agencies or programs? Is there we know about this because Mr. Benson has had opportunity to be here before to sort of give us the heads up on this, but is there a process or how are we, what do we do if, now this is one program, one agency, what if there were 10?
Well, I think there probably are two ways that this could have been dealt with. One, if people realized in the department that there was this overspending problem, they could have requested a change page last year. But I think they didn't realize, which is a damn thing to say about a state agency, but I am saying it because I believe it to be true. And they're just lucky that they got Mr. Benson to come in and get it all untangled for them. The second way is, you know, to come forward with a deficiency request, and that's what we have before us. So, and I would say that I think that you've done a good job of trying to deal with this deficit. You reduced it by $9 million before you got here. But there is more here than is accounted for by either the delay in the construction, the rent, or the growth that wasn't anticipated. And so I just have to say that we don't expect that to happen again.
Madam Chair, those issues that we have control of, it won't happen again. Now, the growth is something that we will continue to discuss, I'm sure, for years to come, and we don't have control of that. But certainly, I think we, Mr. Storkamp and myself, and certainly the DHS fiscal staff, have knowledge and a responsibility to do everything we can to balance these budgets, and we will certainly take your words very seriously, and we will continue to be good stewards of the taxpayer dollar here.
Other questions? Senator Prettner-Solon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Many of my questions were similar to Senator Lynch's, but I think also I don't think any of us are convinced that the way we handle sex offenders in Minnesota is the most efficient management or treatment of that population. And I'm wondering if we've ever considered hiring a consultant or doing an audit to determine what would be the best way to manage this population, because it just seems to be exploding and it's becoming a bigger and bigger problem for us. It seems to me there are other less costly ways of managing them. But aside from that, I'm wondering how you move a patient from a hospital facility to a prison to hold them.
Madam Chair.
When you went to Appleton, I mean.
Madam Chair and Senator Solon, again, we did not move patients to Appleton. We moved our patients to the Moose Lake Prison, which is 500 yards away. The prison, in turn, moved 200 of their offenders to Appleton. So we built a new fence. We segregated those two buildings from the rest of the prison population and housed them in two living units, which years ago were built for MIs and MINDs. So they are in old hospital buildings. and we have sight and sound separation for the most part. And your point is well taken. They are patients. We have a number of variances that we had to get from the health department to occupy those buildings, and we can manage it temporarily. Our biggest struggle is treatment space. Where do you treat these people? Finding a bunk, as I've said so many times, in corrections is one thing, but you need all the infrastructure. You need the kitchen. You need the hospital. You need the recreation area, the chapel, the sweat lodge, all of the intricacies of building that small village for these people that are there to spend a piece of their life. So that is the challenge. I'd just like to say, to give this committee some hope, I think that I think the legislature responded again in the interest of public safety after the 2003 tragedy. And I think there has been an incredible churn of sex offenders both in the community and in our prison system. And my hope is that some of that starts to settle down. I think that will take some of the growth eventually. Dan doesn't quite agree with me on my theory here, but he's the projector. But in addition to that, we now have number two is going to our community preparation service program. I just got notification yesterday that number three got an affirmative recommendation from the special review board. So the back door of this program is starting to show some glimmers of hope as well. In addition to that, I think that there are other possibilities in terms of managing this growing population. We provide treatment in the prison system for those people who are predisposed to probably be civilly committed. I think putting more teeth into that treatment element will start to divert some people from civil commitment. I think eventually we have to look at the low-functioning civil commit. They are a different breed of cat, and I think whether they were sex offenders or not, they would be housed in a group home, 24/7 supervision in the community. And going forward, I think we have to have dialogue about how we treat and how we reintegrate that population into the community too. Because again, 24/7 supervision, I think the risk that they present is minimal, and they're always going to be under 24/7 supervision. So I think there are a number of areas where we can have impact going forward.
And Senator Prettner-Solon, you know, this is an area of great concern to me, and we've had a working group during the interim where we've tried to meet with House members and did some hearings where we got background information about what other states do, and we can continue to look at that. You know, one of the things that intrigued me at the time that I wasn't aware of is that I believe it's Arizona treats their entire sex offender population on an outpatient basis. And it'd be interesting to find out how many incidents they've had or how many reoffenses they've had under that system. But we just don't have time during the session to get into all of that. I do have a piece of legislation which I have not given up hope on, that people could choose to remain in prison when they're likely to be committed to finish treatment if they haven't had the opportunity to finish treatment. And that would be a lower cost proposition on a daily basis. We haven't quite gotten the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections on the same page about the benefit of that bill. You know, the Department of Corrections has me building them two new facilities, and Department of Human Services thinks it's only going to affect 9 people, so we've got to kind of have some more conversation about that and see if we can get on the same page. But we're doing what we can try to figure out to do to reduce the cost of the program and to try to be more efficient. And and I think there are things that we need to keep working on about this, because this is going to continue to be a growth area, and it's going to continue to put stress on the rest of the items that are in our budget. Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, this has been an interesting discussion to listen to, and obviously I've been on the sidelines. I don't mean to inflame the discussion relative to this program, and this is obviously no reflection on either Mr. Benson or Mr. Storkamp, because as the chair indicated, with Mr. Benson's involvement with this program, there have been some significant changes in terms of an attempt to deal with a more realistic budget and get things moving in a way that would be to the satisfaction of the legislature. But there are members in the committee who were elected subsequent to what happened. And to be real blunt, Madam Chair, as you know, and I know this as both a legislator and as a practitioner, there was a significant fight between the governor and the previous attorney general in regard to sex offenders, and this was subsequent to the Rodriguez murder. And that was, as everybody knows, somebody who had been released from the Department of Corrections. And the governor issued an executive order saying nobody would be released absent a court order. And that began the significant increase in population, with county attorneys making many more referrals to the courts for possible commitment. And that's why this program, unlike, I'm not sure about the Arizona program, that strikes me as probably a little bit too much. Even some of the people who are patients in the program. But that's why this is the only program in the country where there's been nobody released in the last number of years. Now, given the nature of the population, there are many of these folks we probably would not want to see released on any kind of an outpatient basis. But that was the genesis of a lot of this, and that's where the increase in cost came. And it's been a big political fight.
Well, Senator Cohen, there are some states that don't have any program.
Madam Chair, I understand that, but again, I think as a matter of public policy, I don't mean to drag either Mr. Benson or Mr. Storkamp into my comments at all, but I mean, certainly there are folks who are under commitment that arguably would be a risk to the public, but there are other folks where arguably maybe there's some alternative.
Well, maybe in those other states they keep them in prison. I don't know, but I do know one thing. This is an area that keeps driving up the cost of our budget. And I hope that people can remember that when the governor criticizes the growth of this area of our budget.
Since
our budget is always under attack by the governor because of its growth, but this is one of the things that causes it to grow.
And Madam Chair, it's a direct consequence of actions he took.
Exactly. And it was one of the most expensive mistakes that anybody could ever have made in state government. That's my analysis of it.
Madam Chair, I just have to say that I think that the legislature and certainly the executive branch took very seriously, though, the public safety issues subsequent to the 2003 tragedy. And I agree with Senator Cohen. There are people in this program that are not treatable, that refuse treatment, that should never be released. These are people that have high, high psychopathy scores. They are people that have multiple victims and have been involved in sex offending their entire lives. Granted, we also have some folks that have never committed an adult felony. But I think certainly somewhere in the middle lies the ultimate solution. I think we did what the public expected the legislature and the governor to do on the heels of the Drew Shadeen tragedy. I felt that from the correction side. It doesn't feel very good to be held accountable for a young woman's death, and I think everybody in our department felt that back in 2003. It was a difficult period for all of us, but I think ultimately you're both correct. I think that we have learned some things. We can look at other alternatives. I think the governor has also signed legislation that does keep sex offenders in prison longer. So I think he, too, is looking at more reasonable solutions to this problem. And I just hope that we can continue to work together on reasonable solutions going forward.
But the sex offenders aren't staying in prison longer. Otherwise, we would see some end in sight here of this growth. So that solution didn't work. So we need to keep working to find better solutions. Mr. Godfrey, are we ready? Okay, I guess we're not quite ready, so we're just going to lay this aside for a few minutes and take up other bills we have on the agenda and come back to it.
Okay.
Members, we have Senate File 481. That's the MFIP and food stamp provisions modifications. Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the division. This bill really has three components. One eliminates the food stamp asset limit, and that has no cost really to the state because food stamps are paid for by the federal government. The thought was it would reduce some administrative burden of having to determine assets at the time of application because the program is administered at the state and county level. And that in this time of high unemployment, there might be people that actually need food stamps that do have some assets that they're not able to liquidate. And so that it would be helpful to families that are in distress. The second provision is one that would, for 2 years, extend the MFIP 60-month time limit. When the federal government imposed the 60-month limit, I think it was assumed that we would be always in an economy where people could get a job of some kind. And so it was, the idea behind it was to let people know that they have a certain amount of time in which they have to find a job. But we all know now there are no jobs right now, and that this sort of is the unemployment program of last resort, and that oftentimes people are in and out of this program. This program's been around for 10 years now, and they've been using up their time at various times, and that it's very easy to see how someone could have used up their 60-month limit and be in a situation now with children where they might have no means of support other than the MFIP program. So that was the idea behind that, to just sunset the 60-month time limit during the time that we expect the economy to be in trouble. And then the last issue is repealing the MFIP family cap. We've had this issue before us before, and we've tried to repeal it in the past and have not exactly been able to do that. So it's in this bill again, and we did get a fiscal note on this issue so that we can have some idea how to proceed in the future in terms of whether we can do any of these items or not. The thing that is not resolved yet is what the status of the TANF emergency funds will be that were approved in the stimulus bill, and whether that money would be available to help us to meet this need. It would seem to me that if we do have money available, that trying to do something to soften the blow of the 60-month limit during this period of unemployment should be one priority for this division.
Any questions from members of the committee? Senator Berglund, in fiscal year 2011, the costs are significantly higher, and I'm thinking that's because of the year two of that 60-month limit.
I think it has a cumulative effect, but it should sunset after that, so at that time then the cost should be going down. The remaining costs in there, I think, have to do with the family cap.
Senator Berglund?
So I'd like to just set that bill aside.
That's my favorite motion, set aside.
And then the next bill we're not going to take up today because we have gotten what I consider to be an unsatisfactory fiscal note. It's one of those things that says there would be savings, but they can't figure out how much.
Okay. Senator Berglund, that's Senate File 460.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you want to go on to 422?
Yes. And I'd like to ask this bill is a bill that was that I've been working on with the Legal Services Advocacy Project, and the provisions in the bill, in essence, are trying to put our MFIP statute more in compliance with the current state of federal law. And I'd like to turn it over to Jessica Webster to explain those provisions.
Ms. Webster, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you, members. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm with Legal Aid. Legal Aid provides free legal services to low-income people across the state. This bill has essentially three parts. The first part really pertains to family stabilization services. And what prompted these changes, which a lot of them we feel are technical changes or clarifications, were that we were seeing participants come into our office that we thought were eligible for family stabilization services, but maybe had some barriers to getting into that particular service track. And those barriers pertain to not having current documentation for an illness or a disability. So there may have been something in the file that was 6 months, 12 months old. It might have been, we had one client with MS that had diagnosis for MS, and the six-month diagnosis was considered too old. So what these provisions would do would say that if a county worker has information that a participant may be eligible for family stabilization services, they can put the participant in those services. They have to help the participant get current documentation, and everything else would be the same. Another provision of this bill would be in Section 1, and that says that participants who are engaged in unpaid work who are coming to the 60-month time limit can also be extended if it is combined with job search for up to 12 months. And the third part of this bill is in Section 3, and it basically says that MFIP participants may participate in a baccalaureate, a four-year education program. Right now, the limit is 24 months for education, and this would say that that limit no longer applies. And this particular change is a change that is allowed under federal law, under the changes in the interim TANF regs.
Questions from the committee? Senator Berglund.
I'd like to just set this bill aside for possible future consideration also. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to move on to Senate File 1402?
No, I'd like to lay that bill over for another day also. I'd like to return to Senator Cohen's bill and see if we can finish that up today.
Okay. We have it.
We have it?
Yeah.
Give it to Pat. Just give it to Pat.
Sure.
Yeah.
So my understanding is that there are a couple of oral changes to the amendment, and if we could have those. If we could get those oral changes read to us.
Madam Chair, on page 14 of the amendment, on line 17, delete $53,408,000 and insert $51,808,000. And on page 16, restore the old language on line 20, delete the new language on line 21, and then on line 28, after the period, there'd be a new sentence that would say, the commissioner shall expend an additional $3,400,000 in fiscal year 2009 only.
Could you read that again?
The commissioner shall expend an additional $3,400,000 in fiscal year 2009 only.
Any other changes?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Can I ask a question on that? 09.
Senator Coring.
Is that in this biennium?
This deficiency request is in this biennium. So this language is trying to pay for this in this biennium, and maybe Mr. Godfrey could go through and explain the amendment and how it is paid for.
Madam Chair, members, what this amendment is trying to do is come up with $14.4 million in funds that are available in this current fiscal year to pay for this this deficiency request for state operated services. The reason it's 14.4 is because as the conversation earlier or discussion earlier had mentioned, $1.6 million of the $16 million will be coming from a county share that's deposited in the special revenue fund. But the appropriation itself is still for $16 million. The first item on the amendment is line 1.4. It's a balance transfer in this fiscal year from the Department of Human Services Systems account fund to the general fund in the amount of $10 million. Then turning to, I believe it's page 7, lines beginning on line 7.8, is an appropriation from the adoption assistance relative custody assistance account and for $1 million in fiscal year 09. We're told by the department that there is at least this amount of money available in this account in the current fiscal year that is going to be unspent. And then turning to the page where there was the oral amendment on page 14, line 17, this is the first of two changes that are needed to bring in $3.4 million of money from the Consolidated Child Care Fund. And on line 14.17, that just adjusts the maintenance of effort language that was in last year's bill that we need this adjusted in order to actually finance this money in the general fund. And then turning to page 16, line, or the new language, I guess beginning after line 16.28, this enables the commissioner to spend $3.4 million in fiscal year 09 from the Child Care Development Fund in order to come up with this additional these additional funds for the deficiency request. And so that those are the three changes.
Senator Cohen.
Yes, sir. First of all, Mr. Godfrey, what's the figure on 1621?
Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, was our previous attempt to try to appropriate these funds for this purpose. After consultation with the department and MMB, we realized that this probably was not the best way to do it. And so we're no longer making the change in 1620 and 1621, and instead inserting the sentence after 1628.
And then, Madam Chair, since this amendment's being proposed for my legislation,
we've done the work for you.
I'd say you have. So that being the case, I just want to inquire, cause and I certainly, Madam Chair, agree with you that as I mentioned at the outset, with these ever increasing expenditures for this program, and with somebody, whether it be the Department of Finance, the governor, whatever, maybe this legislature, viewing this as free money for this program, there needs to be some accountability in terms of how the money is spent and the fact that it's eating up other parts of the budget. What is the impact in terms of what your amendment proposes?
Well, Senator Cohen, we've taken some systems money. We believe that it can be justified based on the fact that there was quite a bit of money in this area of the budget for Health Match, which has been discontinued, and so this is a one-time reduction in their base. The child care money is not anticipated to be expended, and the adoption assistance money is not anticipated to be expended. And those are the three pieces that have been put together to pay for this. And I believe it's important that we pay for it out of existing revenues, because I don't believe it would look too good if it looks like we're paying for it out of FMAP dollars that have been received from the federal government.
And Madam Chair, I agree. And I just wanted to clarify and have on the record what I assumed from looking at the language, which is that at least insofar as the child care and adoption programs are concerned, it's expected those are unexpended balances that will not be utilized during the rest of this budget by the conclusion of June 30, the end of the fiscal year.
That's our understanding. I believe we need another oral amendment on page 7, Mr. Gill.
Madam Chair, on page 7, line 10, delete everything after may be used for, and delete line 11, and then insert the Minnesota Sex Offender Program.
Well, that is an important change, members, because there is a firewall between state-operated services and the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, so we certainly wouldn't want to be appropriating this money to the wrong part of the department.
On that, I thought maybe there was something about fiscal year 09. On the bill itself, line 2.6 also references state-operated services and maybe should be addressed. I'll just put that out.
Line 2.6?
Yeah. The bill itself.
Oh.
Because it's fiscal 09 stuff, it might be okay there. I don't know.
Well, the language actually on 2.11 refers to the Minnesota Sex Offender Services, so I think we're okay.
Yeah, it's just the header, but
I think that's okay.
Madam Chair, we could take out on 2.6, take out state-operated services.
All right, we'll incorporate that into this amendment as well. Mr. Benson?
Madam Chair, just a point of clarification on line 2.7 of the bill. It's actually Minnesota Sex Offender Program, not services.
All right, we'll make that change also. And again on line 2.12. Okay, anything else? Senator Lynch will move adoption of the A3 amendment as corrected. Any discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the amendment is adopted. Any further discussion of Senate File 95 as amended? Senator Lynch, do you want to make the motion for Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, I'll move adoption of Senate File 95 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
As amended.
As amended.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And the meeting is adjourned.